We're talking today about animal-facilitated therapy. And you can see all right with those lights, can't you? Are the lights bothering you? Self-portrait on the benefit of animals. And during the next about 40 minutes, we'll be discussing ways they might be used, ways they are being used. And then I'll hear from you about how you think they could be used, and also challenge me on some of my statements. Now, that first picture that you just saw would suggest that this is a psychiatrist's couch, and that this is a psychiatric or clinical psychological session. We have come more to understand that we look at the whole body, and there are physical changes also. The other night when I spoke to you the other day, I mentioned some solid work that has been taking place in the recent past. When I was involved in the Pets and Society conference in Canada, there was a girl there who gave a report. Her name is Erica Friedman from the University of Pennsylvania. And she told a very interesting story about her associates. She was a graduate student at that time, working on her PhD in the University of Pennsylvania under Dr. Aaron Katcher. And she and with Dr. Aaron Katcher and Dr. Jim Lynch and others, some other physicians at the University of Maryland, were interested in looking at association with peers, touching and so forth, and interaction with other people on the effect of this association on cardiac cases. They were looking at people who were hospitalized for angina or for myocardial infarction. And they did a societal inventory on these patients. I suppose 80 or so questions. And Erica Friedman, a graduate student who's also an animal lover, said, we ought to ask one more question. Do you own a pet or not? Which they reluctantly added. And then they did a year's follow-up on these patients and realized that after they counted up those who had died, they realized that the only thing that had any significance of this societal profile was whether they had a pet or not. In fact, almost 30% of those that didn't have a pet were dead at the end of a year. The ones that had pets, only 3 out of 53 were dead. And they said, well, it's the dogs, because they take them exercising. So they subtracted out those, and there were 11 of those, and none of them had died. So a lot of people, you know, started looking at this and said, well, it must be something wrong with it. You know, that's how you always look at research. You know, there's a hooker in it somewhere. Since that time, there have been 3 or 4 studies that have substantiated this. In fact, they went on to show that that just watching a fish tank reduces your blood pressure and your anxiety level. They took children into a room and had them read and check their blood pressure. And then they brought in an animal, a friendly animal, may not even touch it. And their blood pressure would drop below ambient. And or if stroking it, probably if it's a friendly animal and have good association, the blood pressure will fall, I think, more dramatically, as will the one on the animal. And then they went on to put these aquaria into dental offices, where they were doing dental surgery, compared with other dental surgeries where they just had a nature picture, and others where there was nothing. And then they did check their stress level and their and their anxiety level, blood pressure. And the Aquaria won hands down. But nature pictures were better than nothing. If you had a nature picture plus hypnosis, that hypnosis improved it. But hypnosis did not improve the Aquaria, which is rather interesting. And so you'll see a lot more Aquaria in doctor's office and dentist's office probably from now on. They also they've done a lot of studies. In fact, this changed Aaron Katcher's whole career in research. He's one leading research workers now. Aaron Katcher's a psychiatrist on the left. He was not an animal person. I don't think he'd ever had an animal. And now he has animals. He also has kids, which contributes, I guess, to it. But I think Alan Beck also. Alan Beck is famous for getting the poop and scoop law into New York City, which is no mean accomplishment. But he's now head of the center at the University of Pennsylvania. They also went on, one day they set up for a group therapy. They set up two rooms for group therapy without telling anyone, any of the people that came in for group therapy. In one of the rooms, they put up a battery of cages for finches, but never said anything about it. They were just there. And so they did group therapy for a series of meetings, I guess weekly. Same kind of therapy and same people. And then made certain measurements on these and found out that those who were in the room with the finches, which they were never talked about, had better attendance and more discussion. I'll have probably more to say about this as we proceed, but there are physical effects associated with that. And that's why I'm wearing this my clinic coat today, because now more and more physicians are prescribing animals. A lot of them aren't talking about it much, but they are. Some of them are talking about it. And I just took a few quotes here. One of my favorite authors is George MacDonald. In fact, it was George MacDonald's Unspoken Sermons that probably was responsible for the conversion of C.S. Lewis.
Is that the MacDonald's farm?
No, different one. Sorry. There's an 1800 cleric in Scotland. I know you know better than that. In fact, what C.S. Lewis said about those unspoken sermons was, well, what I owe this person is almost more than one man can owe to another. He says, the bliss of animals lies in this, that they shadow the bliss of those few at any moment on earth who do not look before and after and pine for what is not, but live in the holy carelessness of the eternal now. It's a pretty good philosophy. That in itself will lower your blood pressure, probably prolong your life. One of the great men of medicine early in this century was Sir William Osler. The human heart has a hidden want which science cannot supply. In 1910, Abraham Flexner sort of set the pattern for education, medical education. It also affected veterinary medical education. It still persists. The emphasis was, of course, on scientific medicine, on technology. He was also famous because I think it was 1912, he gave the speech to the Yale medical class, graduation. And he said, I have two disturbing things to tell you. The first thing is that half of what you learned here isn't true. The other one is even more disturbing. We don't know which half it is. Cowper said that the heart is hard in nature and unfit for human fellowship that is not pleased with the sight of animals enjoying life, nor feels their happiness augment his own. It also applies to her own. But this has not reached really, until very recently, any significant part of the health delivery system and the health delivery system component in this country. There are a few true believers, such as my friend Irene Mortensen Burnside, who believes in animals and think they are very helpful. She's a nurse. She has multiple cancer right now. And she, in her new book, in fact, she had us review the human-animal bond portion of it. So the nurses are one of the first group in the health delivery system to recognize some of the benefits. Here is one of the American Journal of Care for the Aging. You see, somebody is pretty happy about their dogs. And here, this is a recent issue of the AD nurse, the associate degree nursing. You notice it's pet therapy, how to do it. There are twos, and they were announcing a plan for this in it. I just recently received this. You can look at all kinds of books written for the aging, on medical care for the aged. And you can turn to the index, and there will be nothing under animals. In fact, in most cases, animals won't even be in the index. Yet over half the people who are old have had association with animals. To some of them, they are critical for them. They are very significant others. But they're not there, which is very unfortunate. This is an example. I suppose one of the few books that written in the last 10 years on this subject was one I wrote on animals aging and aged. Most of mine is about animals, as you might expect. But then I'm regarded as also as some kind of a nut. Now, the human-animal bond, an annotated biography, a person named Karen Miller Allen, in 1975 published this. There were 850 fairly recent references on human-animal interactions, and a lot of references to use of them in therapy. There's an old French saying that says, the tongue of a dog is medicine. That's great reluctance there, my wife's other dog before this one. And that's my wife's hand. One of the things that has moved me, as I told you the other day, is that I have visited all kinds of these kind of people for many, many years who are just sitting in rest homes, nursing homes, convalescent homes, waiting to die, even though they have maybe relatives, close relatives nearby. They hardly ever come to see them. I know some of those that I visited when I was at the University of California at Davis. I was one of the few people that ever came to see these people. And a lot of the story that they told me is what I told you the other night. It goes something like this. I was happy in my home, living independently with my animals. And then either ran out of money and had to go into government housing where they didn't allow animals, or somebody laid a guilt trip on me and said, you know, I worry about you there, and if something happens to you, I'll never forgive myself, so you've got to go to this nice nursing home and we'll take care of the animals, meaning we'll euthanize them. The kindest thing they could have done is euthanize the person as well as the animals, because they're just, it's really sad. And that's, and this is, I can, Marjorie Grinnell used to, she selected animals for the guide dog program. She always had a dog. Her last dog was an Airedale and she died. By this time she's 82. And she went to her doctor and he says, no more animals for you. No more animals for you, Margie, because you're gonna trip over and fall down, break your hip, and that'll be the end of you. And she really deteriorated. She kept going downhill physically. And one day she was out walking, and she met an old friend who was a physician. And he was very frank with her. He says, you know, he says, what the world's wrong with you, Marjorie? you sure don't look very good. He says, well, my physician says since my last dog died, I shouldn't have any more dogs. And the old physician says, Margie, I think you ought to go down and get a dog. So she is a good friend of the San Francisco Humane Society, which is a very good humane society. They have a big program on visitation. And so she got Bruce here. And Bruce, although he'd jump on you if you came here, probably, but never interfered with her and respected her. So her last days were happy days with Bruce. And you could have measured her physical condition go back up as a result of association with Bruce. This is a real tragic thing. I don't expect you to read the fine print, but to remind me to tell you about Sparky. This lady lived in a nursing home where they had a no-pet rule, but they never enforced it. And somebody decided to enforce it. And says, all right, Sparky's got to go, and if he doesn't go, both of you leave. Well, she didn't have any money to go to anywhere else. So she gave up Sparky and died shortly thereafter. She quit going for walks, sort of gave up eating and taking baths. And she'd lost the only thing that gave her unconditional love, made her feel needed, gave her exercise, helped organize her life, socialized her, gave her security, gave her something to touch. And so she died. There wasn't anybody there that didn't believe that they killed her. I think they did. Certainly shortened her life. And the point I want to make here is a very serious one, and it impacts on all of you. And that is that, you know, a lot of people could have said there, you know, it's only a dog. There have been at least four surveys that I'm familiar with of where is your animal related to your family. Now, the returns on these four surveys was, one was 70, one was 80, one was 98%, 98.7%, and the other one was 99% of the people that responded in these four tests said, that animal is a member of my family, or the animals are members of my family. And you ask them, which member? It's a child. And having lost a child, I can tell you that's the ultimate of tragedy. And if you would have come to me on July 17th, 1983, as I wept for the loss of our daughter, Karen, and said, well, what are you grieving about? It was just a daughter. That's what you're saying to people, to a lot of people, when you say it was just a dog or it was just a cat, when they're sitting there crying about the loss of it. And I don't want you to ever forget that. One of the earliest programs I'm familiar with is my friend Phil Arco, who's a very enlightened fellow. He works with the Pike Peak Humane Society. They have a petmobile. They take their animals out, visitation. He started this about the same time as we did, only we didn't know each other were doing it. We were doing it in the Pullman Moscow area of Washington, Oregon, home of two universities. We placed animals. Here's one of the first ones. We played in a course. We placed animals in a nursing home in Moscow, Idaho. Very easy to get in there. They thought it was a good idea. This one happens to be, we call it geriatrics, and now it is. It's been a long time ago. It's a 12-year-old cat now, I guess. It's 13 years old. But this kitten grew up to be a cat and had little ones, and then the party really became informal. Changed the whole nursing home. And they've always had animals ever since. In fact, now there are animals, either visitation or residence, in all our nursing homes in our area for the better. We also have visitation days to farms. We bring farm animals in because this is an agrarian population. This is, I'll give you a few cases now, what I'd call therapy. This is Marie. When we first came to Pullman, we took great reluctance up to the local convalescent home, and they didn't want her there. They said, well, the people will trip over. So we carried her in, and they had some other excuse. But a couple of women bought the convalescent home, so they changed things for the better. So what we decided to do was to set up a therapy room and put Handsome the Cat in it. And then the staff could decide who should be a resident with Handsome the Cat. And the staff all voted for Marie. Marie had had a stroke. She was laying in a fetal position, didn't care whether school kept her or not, and if you went to see her, she'd probably not tell you to bug off, but you probably got the hint. And she had another problem. She had sores in her legs that wouldn't heal. So the staff all voted that Marie would be number one candidate. So she seemed to have a history of cats. So they moved her in with Handsome. And in 5 weeks, her sores were all healed up. You know, although they tried everything up to this point. But you see, if you who know cats, if you start scratching, as she was scratching these sores, that's one reason they didn't heal up. The cat jumps on your hand, of course, and diverts you. That's what they did to Marie. In 5 weeks, she was all healed up. That's a remarkable therapy. Quite reasonably priced, too. And she was pretty much socialized at 8 weeks. In fact, she was on PM Magazine on television. And had it pretty much together. But she stayed in the convalescent home then for the next 3.5 years. I was up to visit her. She was with it and had very good and carried on a very normal conversation. And so her last, so she had at least three good years with Handsome the Cat. Handsome the Cat also had a good time. What's very important here, and one of the reasons I, as a veterinarian, a very special interest in this, is that it isn't fair to put an animal with a flaky person and end up with a flaky animal. In other words, I'm there to protect the animal. The animal's got to be something in it for the animal, too. And there was something in it for Handsome the Cat. Got a lot of petting because a lot of people came to see the cat. They didn't necessarily come to see Marie. But she got more interesting later, so then more people came in to see her. So it's a socialization mechanism. But we protect the cat. In fact, there was a dog that used to come and visit this cat. It was a good friend of the cat's. The dog's name is Daisy. Eleanor carried Daisy around the basket. That's why we call it Daisy the Basket Case. And she'd do tricks, but she also visited a lot of people, but also visited Handsome the Cat. Here you see Marie after 8 weeks, and there you see the dog. Daisy is visiting Handsome the Cat. You didn't believe me, did you? They're communicating there. This is another interesting case. We got a call from the local convalescent home one day. It's up to our People Pet Partnership, which I told you about the other day, which we formed many years ago. And they said, we need some help on a prescription. The doctor has written a prescription for Walter. And we said, what's your problem? Well, the prescription is for a dog. He thinks the only thing he's going to have Walter is a dog. And so it had certain requirements. Walter was bedridden. He didn't want to even see his grandchildren. In fact, he didn't want anything. He just wanted to die. So we couldn't get a Great Dane. We'd crush him when it jumped on his bed. But we had to have some dog that could jump on his bed. We went through one that was a real neat dog, but he was arthritic and couldn't jump on the bed. But old Boof, he met the specifications. His head doesn't match his body, but Boof didn't care. And neither did Walter. And they're very cooperative in this nursing home. They cut a hole in the wall, made a trap door to the outside. And there's old Boof outside, and if old Walter was bugging him too much, he could escape. And so that was a happy arrangement. It wasn't long before Walter was calling up the grandchildren and went, come on over and see the dog. And so his last days were better days. Is that therapy? Well, I think it is. Fulfill the prescription. The next series of pictures, for those of you who visit nursing homes, will bring back, you'll recall people like this. This is really from my friend Marty Wilson, who works, she's a senior flight attendant for Delta Airlines, meaning senior, she's been at about now 30 years. And she's in charge of the visitation program, pet visitation program for the Atlanta Humane Society. She visits about 55 institutions, last I heard, including some mental hospitals. And she taught, and she had a whole series of slides. We were on a workshop in when I was a bicentennial professor at the University of Georgia. We had a workshop down that region. And so I says, Marty, you got to send me this series of slides. Because those of you who have been to nursing homes, you've seen these people pumping, sitting there going like this, watching the Fords go by, not communicating with anyone, just pumping. Well, that's this lady. She was just pumping and never seeing it. So Marty says, well, I got to do something about that. So Marty put an animal in there, and pretty soon she was had her arms apart. And then she really put her arms apart when Marty brought in her St. Bernard. It's kind of hard to avoid this St. Bernard. And this really got her attention. You see her legs, she's putting a, see where her hand is? On the dog, she's touching it. And she was overcome with this. She grabbed old Marty and gave her a smackaroo. Now, if it wasn't for old Marty and the dogs, this lady would still be sitting there pumping. And that's therapy. This is therapy to this guy. I suppose he spends in a nursing home in Moscow, Idaho, at least 4 hours a day watching these fish. And his blood pressure is probably lower than most of yours. we've also found, I'm very interested in hospices. And I don't want to die alone. I'd like to have a nice, friendly cat purring on my breast. And there are cats that recognize when people are in trouble and will stay with, as some dogs will, stay with the master or the mistress through thick and thin. In fact, some of them have to be literally physically separated from you. And they may, in fact, a dog may become very angry if you try to take him away from the master who's ill. But we've used a few cats with terminally ill patients and place them with them. It's very comforting to them. I got interested in this because I got interested in Dame Cicely Saunders when I found out she utilized cats at St. Christopher. She's a godmother, as I said the other day, for the modern hospice movement. She had resident animals and allowed visitation. And I mentioned too that I'm working with some other people at Prince and Princess of Wales Hospice in Glasgow, where I hope they will set aside at least a wing for people who are terminally ill can bring their animals with them, which is the way to go. Schweitzer figured this out a long time ago. We haven't come to that yet. This is St. Christopher's. If you ever get a chance, it's hard to get in there because they have so many visitors. Here you see one of the pets is brought in to see his master who's terminally ill. In this country, there are a lot of programs. This happens to be an outstanding program that's underway for a long time. It's called PACT. And it's at College Station or University Park where Pennsylvania State University is. And these people have set up a program where they place animals with old people, not in institutions, but in their homes. And then they monitor them very carefully. They have volunteers that check on them, and so they don't have to worry about have the dogs outlive them, because they then assume control of the dogs again and put them with somebody else, and they monitor them and take care of them. It's been a very successful program. A great program, my friend Juan Lyon down in Phoenix, Arizona. I don't expect you to read that, but it's to remind me to tell you a little bit about it. They have a support group. It's called the Companion Animal Association of Arizona, where if you're an old person, they might help you maybe with the food, or they'll take your animal to the veterinarian if you're old and can't do it yourself. They have visitation of animals. They have a counseling for adoption. They might have food supply. there are quite a few food banks for animals of old people who can't afford to buy their own feed. And in Seattle, it's one of the leading programs. I helped the Humane Society there on their launching day, and they it's really been helpful to a lot of people who otherwise couldn't have an animal, but really need one. So that's an outstanding program. Pets on Wheels in Baltimore City, Commission on Aging and Retirement Education. They have a program where they, as Pike's Peak, I showed you Phil Arco, they take animals to nursing homes. And one of the great programs, one of the model programs probably right now in the United States is one of my associates, and I helped set up in the Tacoma Lutheran Home. And in fact, when I taught at PLU at Interim a year ago last January, I took the class out there to see it. Virginia Davis is a honcho, and it's one of the few places where they have a paid pet therapist on the faculty. And she has been highly successful. We wrote the prescription for, made the evaluation, and they're pretty much following it. And they have some turnover of animals. And I'll give you a few examples of it. First, they put the cats out in the compound where they could see them, then they move the cats inside. That presents a problem because you have to respect not only the people that want animals, but the people that don't want animals. And some people are allergic, or they just don't like cats, or they just don't like dogs, or they don't like animals. So what we did there, and what Virginia Davis did, for those people who were in where the cats were going up and down the hall, or they issued them a squirt gun. And these people who ordinarily would just sit there sleeping, you see, they had a squirt gun blowing, they were waiting for those cats to come by. And then they'd give them the gun. Well, cats are pretty smart. It only takes once, and then they know who they are. So they dodge by. They have cockatiels, often cockatiels. They're very popular because they lay eggs, and then they... People are up there two or three times a day waiting for them to hatch. And then they finger train them. Some of them will teach them how to do the wolf call. They had one pretty well trained, and when visitors would come in, then they'd give them the wolf call, you see, and a lot of these visitors would look around wondering if some of these old geezers were giving them the wolf call. It turned out to be a cockatiel. But it was good for a laugh. They have a golden retriever. There, and they were taking him to the Alzheimer's ward, and there was one lady who was always raising cane there, hollering and making a fuss, but never when the dog was present. And it reminds me that a lot of people relate to an animal. I remember one lady, I got a letter from her, really from the daughter of this lady. She says, I heard you on television or something. Now, I felt I had to write you about my mother, who, she described her symptoms, they were Alzheimer's. She had been born in Germany, came to this country and spoke English all her life, and then reverted to German with her Alzheimer's. And one day the neighbor's dog came in, just happened to, I don't know how it got in. It was a basset hound named Audrey. And she came over to where her mother was sitting. And her mother saw the basset hound, leaned down and says, "Nice puppy, are you hungry?" Perfect English. First time she'd spoken English in 2 years. And her daughter went on to say, "I guess I should have gotten her dog, because the only time she talked English and made much sense was when the dog appeared." And we have that kind of recall, apparently, for some of these people. They also have found at Tacoma Lutheran Home that there is relaxation, for example, in the therapy room, the presence of an animal, like a rabbit. And a lot of things that happen to you when you get old, your finger movements aren't very good. They have an Angora rabbit there, and the way you harvest for an Angora rabbit is to pull it out, so it's very good. And they've also trained this Angora rabbit to jump through a hoop and sit up and kiss and do things like that. So that's a lot of fun for them. The last addition they have is a hamster, and it's like an eraser. It's it's built, it's a cage is in a racing car. And when it runs the wheel in the racing car, makes the car go. And so they have races with people in wheelchairs with this crazy hamster. I have a lot of fun with that. Now they're going to get more hamsters. We were just there for a consult. It's a fun way to make a living. I don't get paid anything for it, but it's fun. So that's a bit about the Tacoma Lutheran Home. If you ever get a chance, it's worth going there, seeing, talk to Virginia Davis or your group. Have Virginia Davis come and talk to you. Now, here's something you see a lot of. It's people with only, they're getting old, and they got one dog that's also getting old. And you know that it's destined to for great suffering. Because in many cases, if they only have one animal and it dies, it's almost curtains for them. And then they can't stand to go through that again. So they don't want ever, what they really need is another animal, but they can't stand to go through it again. Or they worry, well, let me finish that part of it. So one of the things we recommend for a lot of people who live alone, whether young or old, is to have more than one animal. In this case, I show you Pat here because she had an old dog that didn't have long left. So we got a younger dog in there, you see, so that when the old dog died, she'd still be needed. And although the old dog may have its nose bent for a while, after a couple of weeks, they get in a more playful mood. In fact, might even extend its life, as happened in this case. So that's one of the things we recommend. And the other thing we recommend, and we have fixed up for wills, where people worry about whether the dog will outlive them. There's a lot of sad stories about people putting it in their will and turning it over to some person who, within a month after they die, they collect the $25,000 or whatever it is and then euthanize the animal, maybe a four-year-old animal. This happened twice in the last recent past in the greater Seattle area. One of them was an attorney who did this, but they caught up with him, which isn't always easy to do. One of my concerns here is that there'll be enough young people to take care of me now in my old age, and I'm drawing Social Security. And we have the fastest growing population in this country are my people my age or older. The fastest growing population is 85 and older. And the number of young people putting in money into the Social Security system is bad. If we can come up with a system that will keep people independent in their home longer and happier longer, it's a point in our favor. There's some of the statistics you see, which I have projected, showing that there's people aged over 65 or old by 20 or 30 will be one-sixth of the population. So it's a fast-growing population that's going to bother us. And what I want to warn you about is that this is Maggie Kuhn, who's a friend of mine. She's co-founder of the Grey Panthers. She's a cat lover. And you see, if it comes down to this, Maggie Kuhn and I are going to form the strongest legislative advocacy this country has ever seen, because we're going to get all the animal lovers and all the old people, and there's nobody that's going to beat us. So you can either join us or be on the outside looking in. So I'm just warning you ahead of time. A fellow named Joseph said, one of the big rewards of having loved dogs all your life is the fact that you will be spared a lonely old age as a result of your continuing affection. And that's true. And that brings us to then children. And this is me many years ago when I was working for General Electric Company, and then I'd jump on my bike, my old Raleigh bike. This was about 1953. Jump on my bike and head for home, 2 miles away. And one day a guy came by, he had his back seat of his car filled with cats. He was on his way to Animal Control Center. His wife had put her foot down and said, "You got to get rid of some of these cats." He couldn't bear to get rid of all of these, especially one of them, a steel gray, neat cat, neat kitten. And he said, "You got a dog, but your cat, your kids need a cat." He pulled up alongside me. So in that sack, it's a kitten. And our son, who was the oldest in the family, was never sick, but he was really sick then. He was in first grade, and he didn't even raise his, he'd been sick a couple of days, and he didn't even raise his head from the pillow when I came home with his paper sack, so I just dropped it off in his bed. It wasn't long before I heard a lot of noise out there, and by noon the next day he was back in school, perfectly healthy. So I began believing in pet facilitated therapy on that pony back in 1953. Prescription pet program at Children's Hospital is a very interesting one in Denver. Because a lot of people say, every time you even mention an animal for a hospital, I mean, they shriek, "Ah!" You know, all they see is disease germs, you know. I mean, see them all over. I keep reminding them the biggest hazard for disease are the people there. And that happens to be true. But the Denver Area Veterinary Medical Association, working with the physicians at Children's Hospital in Denver, developed a program over a period of 2 years and set up this program in the Children's Cancer Ward. They dressed the children, the dogs up, carefully selected dogs, put them in the same gown as they were wearing, and it was so successful that now they've extended to all wards except the intensive care and the newborns. And this is at the doctor's recommendation. They found out that it takes their mind off their own problems. This has been true also with adults. When they have an animal, they think about more about the animal. This is a very interesting one here. You may not call it pet therapy, but in a poor section down in Arizona, near Phoenix, this teacher with some really poor performers in this class. But the kids got interested in some stray dogs around. They sort of brought them into class, and she kind of caught on with this, and they made friends with some veterinarians. And the veterinarian, they took them to the veterinarian, kind of got the dogs fixed up, learned something about the veterinary medicine. And then they found a place to keep them for a while, and then they'd place them. It was an after-school affair. And it kind of grew and grew, and it got to be quite an activity for these people. And the principal found out about it, and he says, "You know, what's this got to do with education?" And so he says, "We can get rid of this. We're not the Humane Society." But then she wrote to us in the Delta Society. We gave her some information, and she went to the principal and showed her the records of these students before the dogs and after the dogs in the various courses, because they had to figure out what it cost to keep these dogs, and it entered into a lot of their coursework, you see, and showed that their performance before the dogs and after the dogs was a great difference, that they had really improved, you see. So they still continued the program. This also happened in South Africa recently. We got a letter from one of our members in South Africa, where this teacher got students. She first did it only with the super students. She had them with creepy crawly things to learn about creepy crawly things. She says, and really learn about them and raise them. And then she says, "You know, why wouldn't this work with some of the kids that are poor performers?" And she did this. Like one of them, she introduced him to spiders. And this guy started raising spiders, a fourth grader. And then he added other kinds of spiders. He became an authority on spiders and raised mealyworms to feed them. And in people were coming from all over and getting information on these. And by then, but now when he got to eighth grade, he was almost one of the professors. You know? And he didn't care whether the school kept or not before. He was a very poor performer. And this happened in several of these students. They really got, and we've seen this in prisons. In fact, I may mention it as we go. PALS is a very interesting one, People, Animals, Loving, down in Boise, Idaho. A nurse and Dr. Hawkins here got together, and they brought in latchkey children and 4-H'ers and stuff, and brought them into the clinic to learn about dogs. And then they taped up their hands like you see here, and they give them dark glasses and put cotton in their ears, so they could have some appreciation for old people. And then they had to, with their taped hands, try to open bottles and find their way around. So that was part of their schooling. And then they were now ready, knowing something about dogs and about old people, then they could go down and visit old people in the local nursing home, convalescent home. Highly successful, because if you're going to jolly up old people, nothing better than kids and dogs, or kids and cats, or kids and other animals. So that was a great success. One of the things, if you've never been in a wheelchair, you've come to realize that this is a real obstacle for socialization. I was in a wheelchair for a while because of an injury, and out in the tarmac, I mean, I was flying, and they'd meet me in a wheelchair and then haul me in. I learned a lot about being in a wheelchair, and then a lot of people, they give you a wide berth, huh? They'd rather not mix with you. In fact, they'd like to keep their distance. Well, this is also true with children. They actually did a scientific study at the University of California looking at kids in wheelchairs in schools and in a town situation or a shopping area, and found out that they were a real inhibition to socialization. So then they issued them a dog and checked those people with assistance dogs, and they were very attractive. They were more attractive than people who were normal, so-called normal people. And this is one of them here from Canine Companions for Independence. Real, real neat kid. We'll talk more about this in a few days. I mentioned the other day that one of our former students, Major Anderson, who also has a degree in social work, is the first consultant to the Surgeon General of the Army on the human-animal bond. He's done a lot of great work. Here you see him in the Brooks Army Medical Hospital in San Antonio. And he has his therapy dog there with him, visiting these children. They just love that dog. Now, I'll just tell you about one of the kids who had to have a lot of shots and a lot of blood samples. And he'd fight these all the way. It was tough on the parents. It was tough on the people that had to do it. He called them blood shots. So he brought in this therapy dog. And the kid says, "Hey!" Boy, he got really excited with his dog, and he wanted to play with the dog. And they said, "After your blood shot." So he tore away from his folks, went charging down to where they take the blood shot. They take the blood shot, and he went back so he could play with the animal. So it was a great motivation for him. And so here you see some of these little kids. And there's the dog. I guess that's kind of sideways, isn't it? Maybe they are. In a way, you can see it, can't you? The dog is there. And then when we were down Houston, recently setting up a local Delta Society, this is Linda Hines on the right here, who's executive director of Delta Society. In the middle is Dr. Bonnke, a very compassionate physician, Baylor graduate. She was born with a congenital hip, I think. She limps a bit, but a charming person. And she insists that in the Texas Institute for Rehabilitation Research that they have pet visitation there with a dog. And the head trauma unit, she's in charge of the head trauma unit. And she has the patients pet the dog even in comas. In fact, one day when a person was petting the dog, came out of the coma, and several of them, they had petted the dog while they were in a coma, they hadn't pet the dog. Had a stroke, held her hand. When they woke up, they said, "Where's the dog?" So she's now doing a research project to investigate this. Green Chimneys is a neat place up in Brewster, New York, where this fellow takes sort of dead-enders out of New York City. I mean, kids in trouble, having trouble in school, and puts them in a farm situation, in a nurturing posture with these, with the animals, to learn about farm animals and learn husbandry and other things. It's been highly successful. It really changes these kids. And recently I was invited to two of our leading psychiatric hospitals in this country to talk about using animals in therapy. I've talked to several psychiatrists, and probably one of the better suggestions for handling schizophrenics is to put them in a farm situation. There are some people that believe this would be a great help. Sam Ross is the guy in charge of this. He's a PhD educator. And we'll be having, for those of you on the West Coast, we'll have an our next national meeting for Delta Society. It will be the first time in the West. It'll be in Vancouver, British Columbia. Sam Ross will be there to talk about this. Writing for the handicapped, phenomenal thing. I'm running out of time. I'm talking too much here. I wanted your impression of this. But the hippotherapy is a fantastic thing for people. Now you have third-party payments for this. I mean, they pay insurance for this in Europe, in Germany. In fact, a lot of the orthopedics, orthopods and all, recommend it for therapy for a large number of situations. And those of you from Albuquerque, Ruth Dismuke, she gets third-party payment on using horses in speech therapy. And it's really effective. And riding for the handicapped. This happened to be a girl without hands. A friend of mine has a riding for the handicapped in Liverpool, and she won a big contest. And the fellow that gave her the big cup as the winner was very embarrassed when he gave her and found out she didn't have hands to take it. I've recommended for the Clinical Institute in Bethesda that they use dogs. This left dog on the left has juvenile diabetes. Or have dogs present that have diabetes that are under control, or that have epilepsy that is under control in an animal, to have them available in a clinical center where they do a lot of diagnosis of children's diseases, so that they can show the child and the parent that here this animal is taking its medicine, its epilepsy is under control, or this juvenile diabetes is under control, you see. I think it would be helpful. Prison partnership, I'm going to tell about some of this, of what they're training animals to help handicapped people. That's for Friday. But what happens to these prisoners with association with animals is really phenomenal. And I'll tell you, in Lima State Prison, is David Lee, who started the thing in Ohio, where he found that those wards, and these are criminally insane people, those wards which he had animals in had reduced strife, reduced amount of drugs to keep them quiet, and it was just a better scene. At Purdy out here where we started a program in a maximum security prison for women where they train animals, this person, among others, it's changed him. And I have a dear friend now, I mean a good friend, a recent friend, who's a legally blind. She has her guide dog, and she works in the city's attorney's office in Seattle. And she's worked with prisoners a lot. She works in a criminal division. And she went to Purdy and saw these prisoners. And these are maximum security prisoners, you see. And she was so impressed with their whole attitude, that is, those who were training animals, compared with the prisoners she worked with, prisoners in that were ready to be released in Minnesota. And the attitude of the prisoners there versus these that had animal association was altogether different. And she's so turned on this that she's going to try to make this, I mean, she's taken this on as a challenge to export this. Yes, we've been trying to export it too. I have a committee appointed, Delta Society, an international committee on animals in prison. And I'm sure going to use it. This is Itchy. And I'll never forget him in Lorton Prison in Washington, D.C. That's Itchy, you know, what do the animals do for you? Takes the anger out of me. ask him what his bird's name is. Nunya. Nunya. Yeah, it's none of your business. Dogs with people with handicap. This, very interesting, Carol Antonette Peacock on your right decided she wanted to take her PhD at Boston College. She'd worked with juvenile delinquents. She got permission to interview in-depth 24 serious offenders before their hearings. 12 with her dog present, 12 without her dog present. The results were phenomenal. 280 adverse comments with her in the absence of her dog, 40 with her dog present. They volunteered all kinds of information in the presence of the dog. The results, I mean, she found out so much more with these people with the dog present. And now she's using it in therapy. It's most effective with adolescent girls who've had sexually abused, where they don't trust anybody. But in the presence of the dog, they'll talk as if to the dog, and as they pet the dog. This dog is probably the most petted dog in the country, because the patients come in and they pet the dog while they spill everything that's wrong with them. It's been very helpful. This is work on foster children. Found out that pets in a family really great for foster children. Animal selection is very important. I'll go into that in another time. We run through a remarkable procedure. This is something that can't be taken lightly. You have to be very great care in how you handle this. Like here, we removed the dog because it wasn't working. We had nothing to do with it. A lot of people ask me which animals should they use. Robert Benchley would say that dachshunds are ideal dogs for small children, as they're already stretched and pulled to such a length that the child cannot do much harm with them. That isn't true. A dachshund is not necessarily a good animal for this. My friend John New has a great program in Knoxville, Tennessee. I feel a special obligation to provide for the welfare of the animal. Many pet therapy programs fail because of lack of appreciation of the animal's needs. These are not bottles of medicine that can be placed on the shelf only to be taken down 3 or 4 times before dose. He found out one nursing home had a black lab, and every shift thought he ought to work 8 hours. Well, we put a halt to that. Sometime I'll tell you about this very famous dog. We don't have time now. Nice having someone waiting for you when you get home. The Dr. Busted, best wishes from Jim Davis. He's a Garfield man. This is our assignment. This is my assignment, and I think it's also yours. It's on the Mayo House in Rochester, Minnesota. To cure sometimes, to relieve often, but to comfort always. And that's some of our obligations within the Delta Society. And those of you who are of interest in Delta Society, I have some flyers on it if you're interested. And that's it. I'll take it to where it quits. And anybody have anything they want to say? School is out, so this is where it is, so I can take it out. Got any good warm fuzzy stories? We in the Delta Society we have a computer on which we place all programs having to do with human animal interaction. That's in education, teaching, and research. And I have a list of a lot of the papers that have recently been presented, how animals help in marriage encounters and resolution of marriage difficulties. The college students interviewed found out that those college students were better socialized and dealt better with their peers who had animal association early in life. A very outstanding study we helped support with NIH at UCLA. The old people who they compared to those who used Medicare, those that had animals and those that didn't, except for major procedures. Those who had animals didn't use it as much as those who didn't have animals. So we have this kind of data being accumulated. Up till now, the Delta Society got private money to sponsor research so we could address these issues, because the health, human medicine hesitate to use anything, you know, they want the evidence for this, you see. It's not a bunch of warm fuzzy going to do it. You got to have that. So that's why we got private money and went out to this. And as a result of our last meeting in August, where we had over 1,000 people, 18 papers from 200 papers from 18 countries, As a result of this, the National Institutes of Health have decided they should sponsor a technical assessment workshop on September 10th and 11th in Bethesda on the human health benefits of pets.